welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here. It is Thursday, September 12th, 2019. Very excited to have up back on the show today a regular contributor to the show, and now in a new locale, my former colleague at ESPN, a good friend of mine, is now The Athletic's Mike Sando. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good to be here, Bill. Glad we can continue our occasional chats.
Yeah, I'm excited. And we have a lot to talk about today. My idea heading into the show is we were going to talk about the four matchups of 0-1 teams in the NFL. I kind of figured that would be, you know, geared a little towards the Thursday night matchup tonight between the Panthers and the Bucks, both of whom lost in week one. And then we had, in a offseason that has been full of very strange stories, I would say one of the strangest injuries I can remember when it comes to the NFL, that the quarterback of the 0-1 New York Jets, Sam Darnold, is suffering from mononucleosis. I did not expect to wake up to that this morning. So, Mike, is this – can you remember a player who was suffering from mono in your time covering the NFL?
Well, this is awesome because we had this discussion on, like, our internal, you know, Slack channel this morning, and – so I just started doing research. I found out that Brett Favre missed his entire sophomore season at North Central High School in Kiln, Mississippi because of mono. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Okay. I had no idea that 2002 Philadelphia Eagles fourth-round pick Scott Peters developed mono and never played for the team. He ended up starting for the Giants four games the next year.
Wow.
But wrecked his rookie season. I went through and found – I don't follow the NBA as closely anymore, but Juancho Hernan Gomez of the Denver Nuggets was sidelined by mono. Jordan Spieth in golf had mono late, maybe in the 17, early 18 season. Carter Hart, a second-round pick in the NHL, 2016, missed part of a season. So I guess people get it, but I was thinking, of all the players in the NFL, what are the odds that it's going to be the one player the Jets are counting on for their future?
It does seem strange. Very, very slim. It's really funny because before the year, I was talking with someone, I think on this podcast, I don't know who it was, about Jared Goff and Blake Bortles. And I said, I there's this part of me that just wants to see Blake Bortles in this offense for a month. And we have to get Jared Goff out of the way somehow. And I don't want Jared Goff to get hurt. I'm thinking, what could possibly happen to Jared Goff that wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't cause him a ton of physical pain, that wouldn't be distressful, wouldn't have a long-term issue. And, you know, you can see what I'm getting at. I was like, oh, you know, what if he got mono for a month, thinking, oh, that's crazy to think that a quarterback would get mono and he'd miss serious time. And yet, here we are. I mean, that's exactly what's happening with Sam Darnold. He's going to miss, it seems like, by every account, at least a few weeks, possibly through the Jets' bye. And I mean, I don't know if they were going to beat the Patriots, but this was a really important game coming up against the Browns, and they're in rough shape now with Trevor Siemian at home in week two.
Well, you know, Tuesday is typically the players' day off in the NFL, and sometimes they fly all over the country for whatever. They go see family in Florida or whatever. And there's a chance, I suppose, that Sam Darnold and Blake Bortles spent their Tuesday together. Maybe they're good friends. You know, maybe they were in close proximity to each other speaking.
Sure.
It's possible. I mean, I meant Jared Goff. Maybe Jared Goff will not feel great this weekend, and you'll get your wish, and he won't be too sick, but just enough to get Blake Bortles to play, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. The Jets have said they are quarantining Sam Darnold, which I find curious given what we know about the ways that mononucleosis tend to transfer from person to person. But it's
is there a perimeter set up? You know, you're quarantined. Are you in a room and you can't leave? I mean, what do you do?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Sam Darnold has a nice apartment or a nice house. I think he's probably not in the worst situation, but it does seem like the Jets could probably avoid getting someone else mono if they put a little bit of effort into it. But yeah, it's a very, very strange situation. And absolutely, you know, there's going to be long-term effects, not really over the course of the years to come, but just in terms of over the rest of this season. You'd figure when he comes back, even when he's back, you know, healthy enough to play on the field, he's not going to be at the same weight. He's not going to have the same strength. There's going to be a process of getting back to his football weight. And that's going to take some time. And you know, players don't typically put on 15, 20 pounds over the course of the season. Usually they lose weight. So That's going to be very difficult for Sam Darnold to get back to where he was previously.
What I'm really struck by, Bill, is, you know, when people like you or me, we always talk about, like, you know, okay, what's the best way to build a team or this or that? But you can't account for all of the things that happen that are totally not your plan. You know, number one, you inherit a team that has certain things when you come in, right? They've got maybe your best player is a running back. You don't believe in paying running backs, but you're end up paying this guy. Or you come in and your general manager, Mike McKagan of the Jets, isn't going to be there. He's going to run free agency draft, and he's just going to be gone. And then you're going to hear every day in training camp about how great Sam Darnold looks, and then he's just going to have mono. After the first game, he's just going to disappear for a month.
Right.
Maybe his whole season is affected negatively. I mean, none of these things are in the blueprint for how you or I said we're going to build a team or how it's going to go. It's just there's crises that come up that you just you can't anticipate.
Yeah, and I mean, you think about this is not just the only injury the Jets are dealing with right now. I mean, Le'Veon Bell is getting checked out for a shoulder injury. Quincy Anua went to IR with a neck injury. He has a somewhere in the range of $21 million guaranteed for injury and is on IR for the second time in 3 years with a neck injury. Jamal Adams, Quinnen Williams are questionable for the game on Monday night, at least on the latest injury report I checked out. C.J. Mosley, who was awesome in week one, and then when he went down with a groin injury, missed the fourth quarter. That was the entirety of the Bills' comeback, and you think the two might be related. I mean, this is a team that even beyond the Sam Darnold injury, they just, you know, all the hope that was there for them before the season seemed to dissipate in the matter of a week.
I know, and I just feel like, you know, if it were Andy Reid at the podium every week or somebody who just projects, hey, we got, you know, some process, some calm,
yeah.
It could help them, especially in that market. But they're in that that market where someone had a great tweet. I forget who it was, but it was like, you know, in the last 24 hours, these seven things have happened to the Jets. And none of them went, this was before we knew Darnold. It was, you know, there was a story being written that Gase actually liked Baker Mayfield
yes.
more in the draft. It mm-hmm. was all of these things that had happened. And that's what we're talking about. It's just the chaos of the job. And can you, we haven't even got to the fact that we were worried about, you know, what's the interaction between Greg Williams and Adam Gase over the
right.
whole season. The things we were fearing haven't even come up yet. These are just the things now. So it takes it's going to take some leadership and skill, I think, to navigate it, and it's going to be hard.
And on the flip side of this, I mean, up till a couple of days ago, you would have figured the Browns were the team who seemed like they were the circus. They were the ones that were a mess after week one, and now relatively they look like they're in great shape. They have all their players who are still pretty much healthy. They you know, they had a terrible game against Tennessee. It seemed like a lot of things went wrong, but it absolutely seems like, you know, all things considered, you'd much rather be in the Browns shoes today than be in the Jets shoes.
And you get to play the Jets, so I mean that's a bonus. I feel like, you know, Cleveland, I wrote about them in my Monday column for The Athletic about team, you know, who do you really worry about after week one? And we had some worries about them coming in, and I still feel those worries, but I don't think they're a doomed team. You know, I think
right.
they have some talent. I think they're going to win some games. I don't think they're going to go 2-14 by any means. Their problems, you're right, are problems the Jets would probably like to have right now.
Well, in terms of
the trade problems.
Yes, exactly. In terms of their week one performance, I mean, obviously, you know, you just said that they were, you know, it's not a dramatic decline, but what did you see in week one that worried you? Or even if it's not going to be resulting in a 2-14 season, what did you see that made you think there are going to be issues with this team as currently constructed?
Okay, so there were two things. Number one, I'll just go back to training camp. I went to Colts training camp when they had joint practices with the Browns, and it was wild. I mean, there were fights all over the place, and it was out of hand. And from what we know, that's not the Colts, right? I mean, the Colts aren't. That's not the way they are. The Browns were driving a lot of this, and they were reveling in it. I was really struck by Kitchens was unapologetic after practice. Hey, we're not backing down from anybody. That's what I want to see. So you throw in, of course, they've got Beckham, they've got Landry, they've got some people who may need to be managed to some degree, and even Mayfield to some extent is a young quarterback with a lot of upside, but he's a little bit of a loose cannon there. So I wondered about the leadership. You don't have a steady hand. You don't know what Freddie Kitchens is. He was coaching running backs a couple years ago. Were they going to have the discipline, the self-discipline, the control? Was there somebody who could sort of rein this in if need be? First game, 20 penalties, 18 assessed, and your left tackle's kicked out of the game for kicking someone in the head. So I thought that played into it. And then offensive line was the number one thing on the field that I think, you know, we knew about, but people weren't talking about as much because there were so many other things to talk about. And you're thinking, hey, they got a quarterback. I mean, offensive line is important, but when you got a good quarterback, you can get around that. Well, you know, I think that that was going to be a problem against the Titans. I thought so going into the game that it would be a hard game. I didn't know they would lose. But those two sort of fears, my number one fear on the field, offensive line, number one fear off, discipline, seemed to both be not just concerns in week one, but like they defined their week one.
Yeah, absolutely. I just don't think it'll be quite as bad, certainly in the weeks to come. And I think the line will be an issue, but I don't think it's going to be to the point where, you know, your left tackle is getting kicked out 16 games in a row, which, I mean, would be funny, be entertaining to see how he could pull it off. But, you know, it seems like they should be hopefully in better shape. And if the Jets do have all these injuries up front, that should certainly create more of a concern. And in terms of the Browns, we'll move on after this. In terms of their record over the next few weeks, they are at the Jets, which seems like it's a much easier game now than it might have been had the Jets won in week one. And had they had their roster healthy for week two. After this, they host the Rams at Baltimore, at San Francisco, hosting Seattle, at New England after the bye over the next, six games. So they're 0-1 now. Yeah. What would be to you the sort of record where they can sit there and say, okay, we're in good shape now heading forward? Would it be 3-4, or do they have to go 4-3, or what do you think?
I think 3-4 is probably realistic just because, you're probably not going to win at Baltimore. You're probably not going to win at New England. So right there's three losses, right? You got to build in some margin for error. I think if they can just, you know, weather the storm of some of these early games and hit a stride and get going, they'll be better off. What concerns me about the Jet game for them is the Jets defensive coordinator, Greg Williams, stood there and watched all their practices last year, right? So in a one-game setting early in the year, he's going to have a better handle on what they're doing than other people do. And I think also for the Jets, Trevor Siemian is obviously you don't want him going for 16 games, but in a one game setting, he's played a good game before. You know, okay. I thought some of the best passes in their practice when I was there were him. I was like, well, and the thing on him is he can't throw a nice ball. He just doesn't play quarterback that great over time. But I worry for the Browns that what if you stumble? What if you stumbled this game and now you're looking at the Rams, Ravens, you know, you're going to have Seattle and New England in there. That's my concern more is this game. I think if they win this game, they'll probably be 3-4, maybe be 4-3. And if you're that's okay.
Yeah, I think absolutely. If they can get to 4-3, I think they're in great shape, given what they have the rest of the way. 3-4, you know, I think they're still in the running. I think we'll probably see the what's wrong with the Browns stories. And then once their schedule kind of dies down, we'll get a hotter stretch from them, I think, in the second half. Going through the other four games here, let's get to that Thursday night game. Let's get to the game this evening between the Bucks and the Panthers. Again, 2-0-1 teams went two different directions in week one. We saw Carolina at home, I think, deliver a reasonably impressive performance against the Rams. Just did not work out in the long run. And then the Bucks, that was one of the worst football games I think I've seen in a long time. Tampa, San Francisco. I watched that game for a lot of reasons. And I went back to it last night as I wrote my column. It was a virtually unwatchable game. It was really, really frustrating to watch. I think if you're someone who, like me, wrote before the season about how the Bucks are likely to improve, and I think Jameis Winston has to be a part of that. I don't trust that they're going to get to even six wins with Blaine Gabbert at quarterback. And I think just watching Jameis Winston play, I was really, really disappointed and sort of could not believe how bad his decision making was in a situation where his fifth season in the NFL, he's still making these same sort of mistakes.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you that there was room for improvement there. When I visited Tampa, I was struck by that. I mean, internally, they really expected, you know, Mike Smith had a tough run as D coordinator there, and they thought that the scheming of Bowles come in really elevate the defense, and that could still happen. I think the defense was better. I think they're going to be better from that side. But the thing about Bruce Arians, you know, he's written a book about how to deal with quarterbacks. I recommend it. It's a good book. I took notes in it. I liked it. He knows what he's doing. But he relies on those guys to manage the game well. And I think when he got when he got Carson Palmer, Carson Palmer was a 10-year vet. He'd had some interception problems, but he was, I think he was into the details of playing the position.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a detailed guy who would take care of the football better than a Winston. And if you go back before that, he had Andrew Luck, who, yes, well, he's a little interception prone. I mean, definitely a student of the game, in the details, very coachable. And even when he had Roethlisberger, it wasn't, I don't think it was the first couple year Roethlisberger.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Jameis Winston going to be able to responsibly handle the empty backfields and the times when Bruce Arians puts it, you know, really puts it on the quarterback? And I really thought that could go either way, and it still could. But, you know, I think we saw the fears of Winston realized in the game again. And I was talking to people before the season who were familiar with Tampa. They saw it in preseason. I mean, that was one of the concerns on them in preseason, was they're coaching him well, but he's reverting to the, you know, you get in the heat of the battle and you sort of revert to what you are. That's what it looked like.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, because if anyone is qualified to talk about this and what the perception of quarterbacks are around the league, it's you, because you write the quarterback tiers column every year and speak to so many different personnel executives and coaches about what they think about quarterbacks, not only on their own team, but then also around the NFL as well. And so it seemed to me like, you know, every franchise is going to love the quarterback they draft, you know, in sort of in the first round with the first overall pick, the guy they've built their franchise around. But it seems like Tampa has a, at least relative to the rest of the league, a significantly inflated opinion of Jameis Winston. So, I mean, do you find people around the NFL who value Jameis as a franchise caliber quarterback and a face of the franchise, or is that really just Tampa Bay?
No, I mean, but in fairness to Tampa Bay, I mean, this is sort of what teams do when you take one overall. You give them every chance, right? And so I don't think it's just totally egregious to give him one more year here on a one-year fifth-year option type of contract that's in line with what you'd probably be paying a replacement on a one-year anymore, right? I mean, $20 million is kind of the new $15 million. But I don't know that they even see him that way. You know, I don't know that anybody sees him as face of franchise. I think you see there's some talent there. There's some potential there. But you're really hoping that what's been true for every year is suddenly going to not be true. And that's probably unrealistic.
At the same time, though, I mean, I think about the Bucks, and what do you do? Like you don't have any other option for the rest of the year. There's no point in going Blaine Gabbert. Ryan Griffin, I suppose they could get to at some point. He's the backup as far as Gabbert injured right now. But, I mean, they're sort of locked in. Like, there's no reason for them to go away from Winston, even if he struggles. And this is a franchise that benched him last year because they had Ryan Fitzpatrick. They don't have that sort of, you know, veteran with more upside, I suppose, than a Blaine Gabbert sitting behind Winston right now.
Yep. No, and that one game is not the time to do it. I remember when Bruce Arians came to Arizona, and this is a self-serving thing that the coach would say, but you know, Bruce sort of says what he thinks. He said, never don't evaluate a quarterback in a new scheme till 8 games. So we'll see if he dusts that off. But I just remember, I think I was covering NFC West or was just coming out of covering NFC West, was paying extra close attention. And that was sort of something I filed away in the back of my mind. And if you look at Carson Palmer's first year with Arizona, the 8-game splits were dramatically night and day different. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that Jameis Winston is Carson Palmer.
Fair.
But it's just at least something to have in the back of my mind. And I would give him, you know, unless he's throwing 5 picks a game and you can't look at the team with a straight face and say he's your starter, I think you'd try to go at least that long.
Yeah, and I think on the flip side of this matchup, you look at Carolina, and Cam Newton is someone who, you know, we were all watching pretty closely heading into week 1, given that he's coming off of shoulder surgery. The second half of the season was pretty much a wash for him last year. And, I mean, we saw a guy who the big number that's come out during the week is one pass of 20 yards or more. Did you see some, you know, when you watch Cam play or when you think about the Panthers, are you thinking that they have to throw the ball downfield more frequently? Or were you impressed with what you saw from Cam? What do you think is the sort of the baseline for what Cam has to do over the next few weeks to kind of show that he's back?
A couple things stood out about Carolina and Cam. Number one, I watched the game, and you know, they had a turnover early. They missed a field goal. I think they left a lot of points on the board.
For sure.
I, And for them to only lose by three, I mean, I think that was a totally winnable game for them. Cam, to me, I feel like it's going to be mental. I think it's hard for a quarterback who's had a shoulder injury to just come back and throw caution to the wind. So I was struck by the fact there wasn't much Cam run game in there. And you're right. He wasn't throwing it on the field. And last year, I think he was gun-shy throwing it down the field. And so there could be a mental process for him. I went to their training camp this year and, you know, talked to some people there, and they were confident about his arm being okay. I didn't pick up any fears about it. So I'm going to sort of let it ride out, let it go for a couple weeks here and see if he becomes more comfortable doing that. Like I said, very winnable game for them. I was almost pleasantly surprised based on, you know, some fears I had for their team, and you don't know what's going on with Cam. So I guess I'm not overly concerned yet, but if those air yard stats, if we're citing them in week five, then I think we got something, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I agree 100%. And watching, you know, Cam play again, I watched the game in midweek and wrote about it for my column today. It did feel like he had the arm strength. It didn't feel like last year where he was just, his arm was compromised. Maybe he'd have one play a game where he could kind of dial something up, but otherwise, you know, he was pretty much, he couldn't do anything in terms of throwing downfield. It felt like he just was battling. It felt like he was battling his mechanics. It felt like he was battling his footwork. It kind of seemed like maybe the foot injury that he suffered in the preseason still wasn't 100%. He still seemed like he wasn't, you know, quite consistent with his footwork, you know, dropping back and then moving around the pocket. But the arm strength was there. I mean, when he wanted to make throws and when he wanted to, when he got the proper mechanics, his velocity was fine. The two throws he missed were two throws down, he missed much of those, but two throws downfield. One, which I think was like a 16 yard out. And then one was the wheel route to Curtis Samuel, that one pass over 20 yards, and both of them were open. And Cam didn't seem to have his footwork right and kind of sailed the throws. So it wasn't like he didn't have the arm strength to get it there. It just, his footwork wasn't necessarily accurate. And then, you know, Cam is someone who I think in the past has sort of relied on his arm strength to get the ball out quickly, even if it didn't necessarily mean, you know, the sort of ideal footwork on a particular play, which is true of a lot of quarterbacks. I think, you know, someone, who'd be a good example? You know, someone like a Brett Favre, for example, where, you know, the footwork doesn't always have to be perfect. It's just, can I get the ball out on time to an open receiver? Aaron Rodgers, another good example. And, you know, you can get burned doing that. But with Cam, I think in general, that's been a strength of his. So I think he just has to kind of get to a point where he's comfortable with his footwork, not just in your typical drop back, not just in your typical shotgun snap, but also moving around the pocket, resetting, and then setting again and then making a throw, I think is going to be just something he has to get his sort of body language down with and his muscle memory back down with. But I agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of watching this game, the Panthers-Rams game, I thought it was very winnable for Carolina. I thought they outplayed the Rams during that game. I thought they did a great job on defense. I thought Jared Goff really struggled in this game. You know, the rushing attack did work in the second half. I think as the defensive line tired out, we saw more of the Rams being able to run the ball effectively, but they really did a good job on one of the league's best offenses for a good chunk of this game.
Yep, and so, yeah, some of the question marks we had about the Rams coming in, I think I still have. I want to see it play out over time. Whereas with you know, Cam, I think it's just when you're coming off of an injury, it could take a little bit of while. Now, I have some concern against Tampa on a short week because you think, hey, familiar opponent, but Todd Bowles is not probably that familiar of a guy and could, you know, have some pressures, maybe get some hits on him. I think there's potential for, you know, turnovers for him on a short week. So I'm going to, again, not read overly too much into not a beautiful performance this week either, you know, for Carolina.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think it would have been nice for them. They've been able to pull out that victory and the Saints, you know, didn't pull out the last second comeback victory over the Texans.
Yeah.
They could be possibly 2-0 in the South. That'd be huge for their playoff hopes. But now I think it's just about, you know, getting this first victory. And I think they'll win tonight. You know, I do think that Tampa, even though they showed more on defense than I think I was expecting, I do think it's difficult to see them doing a great job. I don't think they have the pass rush, and I don't think that I think it was more about San Francisco's issues than it was about Tampa's defense playing well when I watched that game back last night.
Yep. Yeah. No, I could see that too. So I'm actually interested in watching the game. I don't know. I love football, but even though this isn't a marquee matchup, there's a lot to analyze with these quarterbacks and how they're playing and the defenses. It should be good.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think it's a, an interesting matchup at the very least. I think there are some, you know, I want to see both these teams play well. They are two teams that I did say were going to improve. I also said that about the Jets. I don't feel quite as great about that, given what's happened over the past week, but we will see. Certainly still a lot of football to go and a lot more of our show to go. We're going to come back after the break and talk about the other two matchups of 0-1 teams here on the Bill Barnwell Show. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined again by The Athletic's Mike Sando. We're talking about the 0-1 matchups in the NFL. Two down, two to go. Let's talk about Bears-Broncos. And I think we talked about the Thursday night matchup this week being interesting. Last Thursday night's matchup also seemed interesting, and we did not get a very fun game. We got one of it was better than Tampa-San Francisco, but not by much. This was at least there were good defenses in the game last Thursday night, but we saw a very frustrating performance from Mitch Trubisky. And I think, you know, maybe this is me. Maybe I'm thrown off. I'm not sure if this is good for the Bears or bad for the Bears, but to me, I'm not that concerned about Trubisky's performance in week one, just because I don't have extremely high expectations for him. I think it was sort of what I expected him to play like, you know, from this week here and there. So I guess I'm not sure if that's better or worse, but what did you think of Trubisky in the season opener?
There's not a bunch of people wanting to bet on the future high. You know, like I would say a couple years ago, people got excited about Derek Carr, and obviously that's cooled a little since then, but there were upside votes. There were people voting a tier higher than what they really thought he was, because they thought he was going to be there. With Trubisky, I talked to 55 people, 39 votes in the third tier, 10 in the fourth. So there were six in the second. That's a small number of people really saying, love what I'm seeing. You know, one of the quotes from one of the guys in the piece said, he's a three. I like what I see, but he's more in the Andy Dalton category to me. Mm. When you get to the playoffs and things get tough, I'm not sure. When he has to win the game for you, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. You need the good run game, the receivers, the good coach, the good defense, and that's 20 to 25 quarterbacks in the NFL, right? I mean, probably need that. It's not an insult, but when you drafted him above Pat Mahomes, above Deshaun Watson, you know, it's not probably what you need.
Yeah, I mean, he maybe not moving the needle, and I think there's an interesting thing happening here with Matt Nagy, in that, you know, obviously they spent this offseason belaboring the kicker issue publicly. I would imagine not quite as much privately, but certainly, you know, I think there was this perception that, oh, if we just had the right kicker, we would have been in great shape to win that playoff game, and then who knows what would have happened, right? You know, you can kind of figure, okay, it's the Nick Foles thing of just, hey, if we're there, we have a shot. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what they could have done differently this offseason in terms of adding talent. I think they were, you know, I don't know that maybe Mike Davis needed to be added, given that they were able to get David Montgomery, but they're sort of having a thing now where it seems like they want to get their best players on the field and just hope that they can get them in the right position. So they had Tariq Cohen play as a slot receiver in this game, and it was interesting. I mean, I don't know if they stick with it. I don't know if they change it, but I wonder if, you know, we're sort of seeing Matt Nagy say, okay, well, what can I do to get the most out of Trubisky, and what can I do to change things up? Because the guy we had last year, you know, even if he's not going to be as bad as he was in week one, which I think he'll get better in the weeks to come, it isn't necessarily good enough for us to win a Super Bowl with that caliber of offense that from what we had last year.
Yeah, and so as an organization, how willing are you to be honest, you know, with yourself, as right, opposed to, okay, we've sort of declared that this is a real guy. Now we have to blame everything else in the end. The killing the kicker thing was kind of comical, I thought. Right. I mean, weren't they having everybody kick from 43 yards because that's the distance they missed? And you're like, what? You know, that's how we're doing it? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. So it's one game. You know, they lost one game, and they could win their next four. You know, so let's not go overboard, but I think you and I have the right feel on Trubisky that there are limitations there, that he's not expected to ascend. He'll get better with experience, but not expected to ascend to where he's a win-because-of guy as much as he's going to be a win-with guy.
Yeah, and I mean, you can still win Super Bowls with that guy. I think Eli Manning might have been that guy for, you know, at least the first Super Bowl with the Giants, and he got better during the playoffs. Joe Flacco, I think, has a reputation, and he won a Super Bowl. So you can pull it off, but everything else has to kind of go right. And the Bears, I think, are going to be great on defense. They're obviously very good there, and I think that You know, Matt Nagy's going to have better days. I think the Packers defense might end up looking a lot better than our perception of it heading into the season. I thought they played really well on Thursday night, but we're certainly going to see. I wonder at this, though, and I want to know what you think about this specifically with Trubisky, but also in general. Do you buy the idea that Vic Fangio, who is the former Broncos, former Bears defensive coordinator, now the Broncos head coach, that he has some sort of special insight in how to stop Trubisky because he was the DC for a couple of years when Trubisky was the quarterback of the team? You do.
Yeah, I do. I do. So let's just say that the Bears quarterback was Tom Brady or a great Hall of Famer. Then I don't think Fangio's insights are necessarily as important. But when things are schemed up to help your guy, and you know, like if we were to just do a statistical breakdown on Trubisky, you'd see there's a bunch of rushing EPA and there's a bunch of other stuff that's not normally why you're drafted as a quarterback high.
Right.
I think those are the types of things that Fangio sitting there sort of has a better feel for the tricks and the way they want to play and what bothers him in practice and what could undo him. I do think that that's a like if the look, the Broncos have their own issues. I mean, they're capable of totally losing the game, but I think it's a game Denver might win. And I think Fangio's knowledge of Trubisky, the whole thing, helps him.
Yeah, I mean, I can see both sides of it. You know, I think to some extent, you know, if you're a good defensive coordinator, you're going to find ways to stop Mitch Trubisky. I don't think you're going to necessarily need that special insight, but I could also see that these specific ways the Bears sort of handle different pressures or, you know, sort of knowing how Mitchell Trubisky is going to think or how Matt Nagy is going to think when you show different things on defense, that does make sense to me. What the Bears might check to or what the Bears might, you know, try and do to change things up. I could absolutely see that. And I will say, I mean, the Broncos, definitely a flawed team, definitely not a team that I would expect to make the postseason, but I thought they were better than maybe the final score seemed to indicate against the Raiders in week one. I thought that was a great atmosphere for the Raiders at home. I thought they had a real home field advantage, which I don't always think about Oakland. I think it's sort of more hype at this point than actual, you know, actual scary place to play from week to week. And a lot of it was just how the two teams played in the red zone. The Broncos had three field goals on their four trips. The Raiders had three touchdowns. And, you know, Joe Flacco, I thought, played pretty well until he got into the red zone. I thought he struggled more there. Seemed to be maybe a step slow in terms of diagnosing and processing things, maybe getting used to the scheme he's playing in. But I thought overall it wasn't maybe as bad of a performance as the final score seemed to indicate.
Yep, I thought Denver kind of going into the season was one of those either way teams. You know, like you wouldn't be surprised if they were 6-10 or 10-6. You know, really. And I still don't know what they're going to be. I think you're right. It was one game out of the gates. You know, let's face it, Flacco hasn't been very exciting for a long time, and now you're putting him in, and it was a little bit underwhelming. But I'm with you; it wasn't a disaster. I'll double back to the Fangio Trubisky thing. You know, I just when you're a little bit limited, like Trubisky, I just say, would you rather face a guy who knows you really well or a guy who doesn't know you? And I think that could be the difference in the game if Denver's able to win it. But you're right, Denver's going to have to do more itself offensively, and that's a tough task against Chicago. So I see it as a potential low-scoring game. You know, what was the last game Chicago was in, 10-3?
Yeah.
I could see this being 9-6 or 12-7 or 15-10.
Yeah, absolutely. Unless there's, you know, the only thing I can think of is if you get a couple of defensive touchdowns maybe going either way. The only thing I can really think that might really spur scoring or a bunch of short fields creating some opportunities for touchdowns. But the Broncos, I didn't realize this until I was doing the research yesterday. I saw Evan Silva tweet something about it, and I started doing a little bit more of a look into it. Enormous home field advantage for the Broncos in September, 29-4 at home and just 12-13 away from Denver. So whether it's teams getting used to the altitude, I mean, this is a Bears team also, I should mention, where certainly with Trubisky, I don't know about the rest of the team, I can look it up as I talk about it, but they're a team that did sit Trubisky for the entirety of the preseason. He didn't play, I believe, didn't attempt a single pass, if I'm not mistaken. So this is a team that, you know, not necessarily in the ideal shape in week two, and I thought that I'm sure they did their best, but Trubisky, okay, did he play during the preseason? No, he didn't play during the preseason. A lot of their weapons didn't play during the preseason. I mean, this is a team that seemed to sit the vast majority of their starters for the preseason. So, you know, going into a place in Denver where even if you're in great shape, you're going to struggle with the altitude, you're going to struggle to kind of stay healthy. That could be a compromising situation for the Chicago Bears.
Well, yeah, I do remember something on that. So if you go back to 2013 in September at home, the Broncos are 12-0. Wow. Okay. I'm just like adding years to see when their first loss is. 14. Okay, so if you go back to 2012, there's a loss, but they're 14-1. Seattle's actually 12-0 in those. But it's interesting. Yeah, I imagine some of those games had Peyton Manning playing quarterback, and then yes. you're going in there when it's probably still warm, and you're at the altitude, you know, and you're not used to it. They are, and they've had some good teams, and it's interesting.
Yeah, I think it'll be a low-scoring game, if fair to say, but I think it could be, you know, a low-scoring game that's low-scoring because you have two good defenses as opposed to just two offenses that are a bit of a mess. All right, Mike, well, let's get to more of these 0-1 matchups in a second. But first, guys, they say the best offense is a good defense. And that's especially true when it comes to the fuel you put in your car. It's time to help keep your engine running like new. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline is engineered to defend against four main engine threats: gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction. It's their most advanced fuel ever, protecting your engine like a solid stiff arm, a huge hit, or a last-second block. Like defensive lines, not all premium fuels are the same. Now that's fuel for thought. And if you're a Fuel Rewards member, you save at least 5 cents per gallon on every fill-up with gold status. And if you're not a member, I would strongly recommend you download the Fuel Rewards app or go to fuelrewards.com to join and never pay full price for gas again. Now back to the show. Let's finish up with two teams you might expect to have a good defense this year, and neither of whom showed much on defense in week one. The Jaguars, I guess the Texans did force an interception, but Jaguars-Texans, let's start on the Texans side of things. Bill O'Brien, having a quite this season so far as the unnamed or untitled personnel executive. I mean, this is an organization now that it certainly seems like they're overreacting from week to week or from month to month in terms of the holes in their roster. I mean, they needed a receiving back, so they traded a fourth-round pick that's likely to be a third-round pick for Duke Johnson. They had no left tackle of note, so they trade two first-round picks and a second-round pick for Laramie Tunsil. Now, after Aaron Colvin really struggled in the slot in the first game of his second year of his free agent deal, the Texans cut him after week one and ate, I believe, over $7 million in dead money. He got something like $18 million for 11 games in a Texans uniform. And I mean, you know, I understand being frustrated, but it just seems like this is an organization that is going to tilt at windmills. Is that the right phrase? Where everything that happens from week to week seems to, you know, cause them to totally change what they're thinking or what they're doing.
Yeah, if you ever wondered what it would be like if, like, Mike Zimmer got to make the decisions after every game and there wasn't, like, a GM in the front office, not picking on Zimmer, but I'm just saying a coach, you know what I mean? Like an emotional coach. Think of emotional coaches. Think of their, you know, their face turning red or whatever. That's what it feels like is happening with Houston. Like, usually behind the scenes, you know, the head coach maybe, oh, that's it. We're cutting this guy. I'm done. And then they go, okay, hey, listen, Bill, you know, hey, calm down, deep breath, you know, right. Look, if we do that, here's the implications of that. I don't care. I cannot have this happen again. Listen, hey, take a break, full drink of water, you know, and there may not be anybody to say that right now. And look, I can understand why Bill O'Brien may have been frustrated with the way things were going with their previous personnel people, right? I mean, you could see they weren't fixing their offensive line. They got outmaneuvered in the draft, right, for the tackle from Washington State. They ended up getting somebody else who doesn't look like he's doing as well out of the gates. But the solution could be worse than the problem for the long-term health of your organization. So that's what it looks like now. And every time there's a rash decision made that normally wouldn't be made, it feels like it's the head coach acting out of disproportionate power and frustration.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seemed like, you know, this was the issue with the Texans for years, and that Bill O'Brien seemed to want more power and seemed to clash with the executives in that front office, and they didn't always do a perfect job by any means, but you know, for all the moves they made after you trade Jadeveon Clowney, after you acquire Duke Johnson, after you you know, send multiple first and second round picks for Laremy Tunsil and Kenny Stills, even given that they played pretty well against the Saints, it sort of seemed like they had the same issues. They struggled to protect Deshaun Watson, who did get injured during the game, was clearly not 100%, still made some incredible plays. DeAndre Hopkins was awesome, but, you know, couldn't come up with a stop when they needed one late with the Saints. Maybe they were unlucky to fall to a 58-yard field goal, but, you know, it's not as if they traded for Tunsil and suddenly their pass protection problems were fixed. I mean, they still struggled to keep Deshaun Watson upright.
Yeah, I mean, your number one concern coming into the season was too much on Deshaun Watson's shoulders without enough protection. He's going to get beat down. And we saw really everything we thought of the Texans in that game. The amazing Watson. I mean, 70-some yards in 13 seconds. Wasn't that what it was? I mean, they get the ball 50 seconds left. They're in the end zone at 37.
Yeah.
Awesome. I mean, that is, you can't do that. I mean, that's historic. It's amazing. But he's also diving across the pylon and getting a back injury, and he took a bunch of hits early in the game. And at the end, they didn't find a way to win, win because they gave up the 8-yard or whatever reception that they couldn't give up based on the scheme they were playing. So that was sort of Texans in a nutshell: the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, maybe we'd feel differently about them if Will Lutz hadn't hit a 58-yard field goal. Maybe that's, you know, they were unlucky to have that happen. But I just don't have a lot of faith that Bill O'Brien's going to be making the best decisions for this team in the weeks to come. And, I mean, you're not going to get those incredible two-play drives. What happens if Deshaun Watson gets hurt? And then you've given up two first- and second-round picks for, you know, to sort of try and paper over a year where you don't have a great shot at competing. Maybe it'll work out great, but I am.
Yeah. Well, there's always competing interests between the long and the short term, and the coach has to worry about the short term first. That's his job, right? And so the way I look at the Texans as a team that was willing to pay $20 for a gallon of gas, right? And we go, you've got to be an idiot. But if you're on the side of the road and you need 1 gallon of gas to get somewhere, you'd pay $20, right?
Sure, of course.
They're sort of on the side of the road making these decisions. We don't have a left tackle. We're on the side of the road. Okay, $20 for a gallon of gas. Woo, we got him. Well, it helps you in the short term, but you really need that $20 to eat or have a hotel room too. You know, so that's what it feels like to me, just the conflict between the coach who's in his, what, sixth year? Maybe going into his sixth year, you know, versus the long-term vision, which in the last year of the organization, the owner's passed away. GM's been fired. They tried to get Caserio. Mm-hmm. They didn't. Looks like they're waiting for Caserio to put together a committee. And, oh, yeah, we got a game next week. You know, and you put all those things together, and it's not the best cocktail or recipe for putting together a plan the way we would do it if we were at the Sloan Analytics Conference saying, what's the best way to put together a team, right? Totally different atmospheres.
If you were Nick Caserio, would you want to come to Houston, given what's happening here?
I guess it depends on, you know, what level, what type of my contract looks like. I'd be very excited to come with Watson there, but I would need to know, okay, what's the status of O'Brien? Do I love him? Do I want to work with him? Do I want to hire someone else? Do I have the power? I think it could be really appealing with Watson, but you've got to make sure that the organization is going to be the run way, you know, run the right way in your vision, you know, how you want it to be done. You can't just be going in there not knowing how it's going to be. You need a bunch of stuff in writing. And I think he seems like somebody who can get that, right? He's in a great situation now. And if he's hot commodity, maybe he can get that.
On the flip side of this matchup, get to the Jaguar side of things. I mean, it's strange. I've rarely have I seen a team lose their starting quarterback in week one, allow 40 points to the opposing team on offense, and still kind of feel good about themselves heading into week two. And yet, Gardner Minshew, whether it's just that he's a fun story, whether it's that he played really well against Kansas City, I mean, it seems like, you know, like Sam Darnold, it feels like, oh, the sky is falling and the Jets are doomed. With the Jaguars, it's like, okay, well, let's see what Gardner Minshew can do. He looked pretty good. So, you know, I'm intrigued to hear what you think.
Okay, so I put them on my list of teams that I'm worried about after week one because I feel like they have some of the same discipline issues that we talked about with Cleveland, and you see Miles Jack getting pulled out of the game. And there's always something there on that front, whether it's Fournette or somebody. I feel like they're a team that's sort of been on the borderline of being out of control for last year and this year. I felt like Nick Foles was a key to sort of calm the waters. I think he's a, you know, sort of a laid back guy, but a respected guy, yeah. You know, sort of a voice of reason. And I think he's a good enough quarterback, who knows, over the course of 3 years, but over the course of a season, I think it would be worse. I think he came in there with some pedigree off of what happened in Philly, some credibility. Now you suddenly turn it over to Minshew, and it was great fun for the game, for a game, and he may be good. I love the fact that it's not another year of Bortles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen that. I think you'd feel totally down about him. So I'm excited to see more of Minshew, but also just sort of realistic that I think when you lose Foles and you have those issues on your team, that it's going to come back to bite you. So I feel I'm worried about them, but interested in watching them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see Minshew play, but I have to admit, I think I was disappointed by how the defense performed. I mean, this is a defense that, at their peak, you know, they were able to either shut down Ben Roethlisberger or slow down Tom Brady. I mean, they were a difference-making, regardless of opponent caliber defense. And we did not see that in week one.
Did they win in Kansas City last year or play a real slugfest game at Kansas City last year, or did they lose big? I can't remember. It seems like they played there. And because me coming into this game was like, you know, Kansas City's going to score on everybody. So I don't think it's a huge, terrible concern that Kansas City scored 40 on you, especially when you lost your quarterback. That could happen. I don't think they're good enough defensively to just hold down Kansas City. I don't know that anybody is. So they, I will. Wasn't there a game last year? Heard of
they
that?
Played last year. Kansas City won 30-14, but that included a pick six, and Blake Bortles threw four interceptions. So, I mean, it was.
Jaguars defense was actually pretty good, I think, in the game. Yeah. You know, it wasn't horrific for giving up that many points. So, I guess I just have a little bit lower expectations for them. It's funny, sort of watching the game. So there were two notes I came out of the game on. Number one was Minshew and Foles were each one of one on passes of 30-plus air yards, and Bortles was one of 14 last year. Mm-hmm. So right there, I'm like, okay, whew. The other weird thing on Minshew was, so as I was kind of watching it, it felt like a bunch of dink and dunks, but he was 8 of 8 for 185 yards and two touchdowns on passes beyond the sticks. Well, that's pretty good. I know it's a little bit of a garbage time feel for a while when you're behind, but there was some promise there. I do want to see more. I just think it's unlikely probably that your backup's going to come in and be Kurt Warner.
Sure.
So it's probably a bad thing to lose Foles for a while, but I'll be watching their game. I kind of want to see the guy more.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe the takeaway from last week is not that the Jaguars defense is disappointing, but just the Chiefs defense might not be that much better than it was a year ago.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no doubt. But when you score 35 or 40, you know, your defense can allow 25 or 30.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in this game. I mean, I could see Minshew playing well. The Texans obviously are a work in progress on the defensive side of the ball, but it could have been a one-week mirage, and the Texans, you would figure, have a much better quarterback and a defense that if the Jaguars defense was what it's going to be in week one, you know, could be their equal.
Yeah, I would guess that it's a harder game for Minshew and that Deshaun Watson maybe is the difference in the game. I mean, that's just trying not to overthink it, right? I mean, you got one quarterback who we know can make the plays and rally his team, and the team can get excited around him versus, you know, another one that is really unproven. So it'll be a great win for Jacksonville if they can get it. You certainly hope for all they've been through at the quarterback position, you know, going up against another guy that they could have had, right? I mean, right. This is the draft they took Fournette, right?
Yep.
They took Fournette, could have had this guy. So it's just tough because they're playing them in back-to-back weeks, right? They're playing Mahomes and Watson.
They play Mahomes and Watson.
Being reminded right. Who they didn't draft. Or they
strangely, it worked out pretty okay in the long run, I guess now. But, I mean, this was the Jaguars team that lost to the Colts in Week 17 the year before they drafted Andrew Luck, where Andrew Luck would have gone to Washington if they had won that game.
Yeah, but it would have worked out way better to have years of luck.
Yeah.
So, Yeah. I mean, when you get a chance to draft a good one, you got to do it no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an interesting game. I think I lean the Texans. They are 9-point favorites, but I could see any possible outcome here. I feel like is on the table.
Yeah, 9. That's a lot, isn't it?
It is. I mean, but it's in Houston. It's the home opener. The Texans, yeah. I mean, this is a team that's selling out to win this year. So, I think the performance against the Saints probably inspired people to, you know, kind of back them. But this is a team that even last year was inconsistent from week to week. And they were. I mean, this was I think Warren Sharp was the one who heard about this, but they faced a ton of backup quarterbacks last year. And here we are in week two, and they're facing another backup quarterback.
Yeah. Yep. I'm excited about it all. I just think there's a lot of storylines, and it's funny. We previewed 4 games with 0-1 teams, but it's all interesting. These are all really interesting teams.
Yeah, I mean, there's games up and down the docket this week. You have Patriots Miami, which I think is a interesting, you know, one of the biggest home or biggest away favorites in league history. We have Chargers Detroit, which could be compelling. We have Saints Rams, which is one of the biggest games of the year. Eagles Falcons, which we don't know what we have with the Falcons right now. And then Jets Browns, which seemed like it was going to be a really fascinating matchup on Monday Night Football, and now is fascinating for different reasons.
Yep, totally is. So I'll be glued. I'm sure you will be too.
I will, of course. And Mike, if people want to check out your work, you have a new place for them to do that.
I do, The Athletic, yep. You can find me there on the app. You can Google Mike Sando, The Athletic, you'll find me. And also on Twitter, it's Sando NFL.
Awesome. Well, Mike, I'll be back on later on in the season to talk about the NFL, but thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guest today, The Athletic's Mike Sando. And guys, also, be sure to check out the Adam Schefter podcast this week, where he talks with Randy Moss. You know who Randy Moss is. I don't need to explain who Randy Moss is, but remember to subscribe to the Adam Schefter podcast and the Bill Barnwell Show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. More audio coming next week.